Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host.
If you enjoy this podcast, I need your help because this show needs to grow and these episodes need to be heard by more people. And I love hearing your feedback on the episodes. So there are a few ways you can help out. Number one, share this with a friend or someone in your family, post it on a chat. Number two, rate and review this podcast. Number three, if you feel so generous, you can go and treat me to a cup of coffee. There's a link in the show notes, buymeacoffee.com/Fran. This goes a long way, especially because I don't drink coffee regularly, but you get the gist.
My heart goes out for all our brothers and sisters in Israel. We are living through crazy times. You are in our prayers and thoughts at all times.
Today's episode is special to me. It is our 299th episode, which means that next week is supposed to be the 300th episode, which I will be celebrating over Pesach with some freedom and time off and rest. So you will be getting a replay episode. There's also a throwback episode for today, the episode we did with Shana Aronson back in the day, the last time we had her on. So I hope you learn from this episode. I hope you share it. For my due diligence, I have to tell you, I have all these new music releases out, specifically for Pesach. We have Melody of Miriam, new music video, and a cover of V'hi She'amda of Yonatan Razal's original / Yaakov Shweki's song. Links will also be in the show notes. Without any further ado, here we go. Enjoy the show.
Shana Aronson, welcome back to the Franziska Show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So since you've been here last time, can you catch us up? And if you can add in your religious background as well. We like to have that for every guest.
Okay, I don't remember the last time we spoke, so I don't know if I can fully go back.
JCW.
Ah, okay. So I am the director of Magen, which is an organization in Israel, where we, I think really the first, Merkaz Siyua, which is like the national sexual abuse and rape crisis centers. So we were the first one that worked specifically within the Haredi community and the religious communities. We work with survivors of sexual abuse in a number of different areas. So first, our first kind of department deals with awareness and education. So we have a lot of different educational programs, programs for parents. We do trainings like for law enforcement, for professionals, as well as like, for example, we created coloring books for Haredi kids, like around the whole subject of personal safety and things like that. And then we have our mental health services department. So we have social workers who work with clinics all over the country. So we help people find therapy, as well as funding for therapy if they need it, as well as we run a number of different support groups for survivors of abuse, parents of survivors of abuse, for ex-wives of perpetrators of abuse. So a lot of different groups. And finally, we have our what's called in Hebrew livoy, which there is no word for in English, like accompaniment support for survivors going through law enforcement and legal processes and proceedings. So that can be like physically going with people to the police. It can be helping victims prepare for court, like understanding what it's going to be like, what the setting is and what they can expect, as well as helping support survivors through the process of going to Bati Din, if that's what they choose to do, as well as some like private investigation work in cooperation with law enforcement and the media. So that's basically what we do at Magen. We have 14 staff members now, as well as quite a few volunteers. And they are a combination of psychologists, social workers, criminologists.
And you are in charge?
Yeah, I'm the executive director of Magen. I grew up Haredi. My parents were from more of like somewhat of a Belchuva backgrounds. We moved to Israel when I was 12, but then I went, it didn't work out so well for me. Not a great age necessarily to make Aliyah. I went back to America for high school. So I was there, well, for some of high school, I was there for a while in school. And then I started college and I came back to Israel, met and married my husband here. And now I am raising three children here, which is always, you know, very...
Not Haredi or yes Haredi?
Yes Haredi. Not the same kind of Haredi that I grew up, but pretty much within, still within the community.
Are you able to comment on how JCW ended or how it turned into Magen or how you transitioned from one to the other?
That's a good question. It's been like so long. So first of all, JCW didn't end when we separated. There was a decision that was made mostly by our board to separate the Israel office. Like at the point that we separated, we were doing a lot of different programs in Israel that weren't going on the American side. And it just like became more and more clear that it made more sense to kind of run the two organizations separately. So the two organizations separated. I mean, Magen was an independent organization, but we were operating like within full cooperation and kind of like as part of the work of JCW. So the work that we were doing pretty much in many ways continued. It was like the same kind of work, but there are a lot of things either that we were already doing here or that we have since started doing here that weren't really part of the JCW model. And then obviously things that we don't do, the JCW did. Most notably, of course, the Wall of Shame. We don't have anything like that here. All the kind of investigation work that we do is working with the media or with law enforcement. We don't have like an internal kind of exposure system for cases of abuse. So it's different, but there are many similarities in terms of like the kinds of services and the kinds of support. And then JCW continued running for a while after that.
I recall it being a little juicy or something. They couldn't comment on things.
I mean, I think that probably it wasn't much juicier than I know it's going to be very disappointing, everybody. It wasn't so much juicier. I think at the time it was like very sensitive because when you have any sort of, whether it's like staff leaving or like any sort of moving
transition,
restructuring of an organization that's dealing with such sensitive things, such sensitive content, such sensitive, you know, support. So it was definitely very sensitive initially because there was like a lot of decisions that had to be made in terms of how, also in terms of like our commitment to the survivors that we were supporting. There was like a good 6 months to a year where every single survivor that we spoke to, meaning the staff of Magen in Israel, had to tell them, like, for the sake of full transparency, we are now Magen. We're doing the same. Now, honestly, most people don't
care.
Like, when they're so desperate for help, they just want to make sure that they're going to continue getting help. And most people were like, I don't care what you're called. Can you still help me? That was really the response that we mostly got. But still, there was very much like a lot of awareness on my, like, I just feel like you have to be very transparent. People need to know who they're talking to. I don't want there to ever be a situation where a survivor after the fact is like, I didn't know that you were X or working with Y. And had I known that, I wouldn't have told you this or I would have told you this. Like, I, you know, people need to be fully informed. So it was definitely very sensitive at the beginning, but not so much because like anything hugely dramatic happened, just because the nature of the work makes it a little bit like, you know, sensitive and there's a lot to consider.
Okay. Can you tell me how many reach outs do you get per week or per month? How many new cases get brought to you? And then how do you decide what to take on, what not to?
So we were getting, it's actually it's gone down since the war started, believe it or not, like in terms of the new cases. Sometimes that's surprising to people, but the same thing happened at the beginning of Corona. When people are in like a real survival space mindset, they often will not reach out for support for anything that isn't like their immediate physical needs. Like if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like when people don't know where they're going to sleep at night or if they're going to have food tomorrow, like they're not thinking about their mental health or like it sort of gets relegated to not being the top priority. So we have less reach outs now than we did before the war. I would say before the war, we had an average of about 50 new cases a month, as well as about somewhere between 60 to 70 new inquiries a month. The way that we break it down is a case is opened when somebody reaches out and they're looking for some kind of ongoing services, whether that be in the mental health side or in the law enforcement or investigation side. And then an inquiry is when somebody reaches out and it's like either a one-time or like a couple-time conversation. They want advice about how to open up a conversation with their kids or how to have a conversation with their, I don't know, the staff in their kids' school, like something that's more of a one or two-time conversations for like advice and guidance and not so much ongoing services. So yeah, so it was about 50 new cases a month and about 60 to 70 new inquiries a month. Now it's more like somewhere between 30 to 40 new cases a month and about still close to about 60 inquiries a month, somewhere around there. And what we anticipate is going to happen, and we're already seeing it slowly rise, is that as
catch up
more and more, Yeah. During Corona, we had like after the first, I don't know if it was 6 months, 9 months, absolute explosion, like drowning in cases. Also, there was the Walder case broke during that period as well. And that was very intense. There were a few weeks where I worked in a way that was like not like we were doing intakes like 24/7, like literally 24/7. We were on the phone and everyone was doing intakes. No one was even doing any work. We were just doing intakes and we were just telling everybody it's going to take a while for us to get back to you, like with the ongoing kind of stuff. So if there's anything that's emergent, like please get back in touch with us. Obviously, we'll deal with that right away. But for the most part, it was like literally just intake, like around the clock for weeks and weeks and weeks. To the point that, like, I usually have a pretty good memory when it comes to, like, the basics. And I would, in, like, the months afterwards, when I was going back and actually going through the intakes to reach back out to people to follow up, there were conversations where, like, I know they were my conversations. It's my notes. It's my voice. This conversation happened.
No
I recall. None. Zero. It was like, it was just this, yeah, it was a pretty, pretty intense time.
I wanted to bring up a few topics today. The first one being enablers, and then an adjacent topic of enabling enablers.
Mm-hmm.
It has come up. So I'd like to hear if you have any examples or cases you've worked with where that was a big component of the case. And then I'll bring up a case.
Sure. I think that when it comes to people that enable abuse or enable abusers, there's, I don't know, I guess you could maybe break it down into like two different categories, probably more, but two different, you know, basic categories. There's like the active enablers who are like actively allowing abuse, meaning they know abuse is happening and they are actively intervening in some way to either get the victim to not stop the abuse, like not take action, or actively facilitating the abuse in some way. And then there's passive enablers that just don't want to get involved. I just don't want to get involved. They just don't want, you know, it's not my business. It's not my this. I don't have the authority. Who am I? I don't know. Both are very problematic, but obviously they're problematic in different ways. I think that a big part of our work, as far as wanting to make sort of working towards systemic change in the Haredi community, has been dealing with the active enablers, like going after them. So whether that be lawsuits, which obviously, like, you know, lawsuits when it comes to survivors suing not just their abusers, but the institutions that enabled the abuse or others that enabled the abuse. Sometimes people like look at that as almost like it's like a dirty word, like, oh, you're just after the money, or you're after the... No, that's not even what it's about. Like, first of all, Magielo, if a victim wants to sue and get monetary compensation, like they should get some kind of compensation. If that's what the law allows for, then they deserve that. But honestly, 9 times out of 10, survivors are just like, I just want this addressed. I just want this validated. I want it to be clear that this happened. I want these people to not be able to do this again. I want them, even if they're not going to stop this kind of behavior because they care, they should stop it just because they care. Like we can all agree that really people should not be enabling abuse because it's horrible and abhorrent and horrific and terrible and destroys lives and souls and everything. Like we all, I hope, can agree on that. But if you can't make someone like care, you can't make people care, then you can hit them where they do care, which is often their pocket. Like that's sometimes all that people will really pay attention to. So we've had like, we actually, not too long ago, one of the cases that we were dealing with, one of our staff members had called up a certain rabbi pretending to be a therapist who was seeing this girl from this school that had been abused, and to see his reaction. And what was so interesting is he got really, like, he was really adamant with her. And he said, you can't tell her. It's very important that you not tell her that the rabbis told her not to go to the police. You can't tell her that, because eventually that will come out and we will all get in trouble and we'll get sued and the police will get involved. Like, you can't tell her that the rabbi said not to report it. And it was the first time that I heard someone say that in those words. Like, they admit, like, again, he's not saying what he should be saying, which is the victim should have the right to do whatever she feels she needs to do to take care of herself or whatever her priorities are. That would be what I would like him to say. But at least there was like okay, I'm going to do the right thing, even if it's for the wrong reasons, because I realize I'm going to get in trouble eventually. Like, this will come back to caught me. Yes. So yeah. So there's, I think it's really important that the active enablers be dealt with in every way that is to say, the hook, like whatever the law allows for should be done, because sometimes that is the only way to get something like that to stop. And ultimately we need to deal with the enablers, because abuse is always going to exist. I do. I know maybe that's not a nice statement coming from me. Like I'm supposed to say that abuse, one day we will eradicate abuse if we all just, but I don't. I don't have a solution or a 10 steps. It's like, and this is how we will eradicate abuse. Abuse is a human problem. It is something that has existed for way longer than we've existed. And I think that it always will exist to some degree, but we can certainly change how we deal with it as a community. And we need to do that. And so that means dealing with enablers for sure. As far as the passive enablers, that always gets much more tricky. First of all, because there's generally less legal, like just in purely legal terms, there's usually less that can be done for someone who just doesn't want to get involved, unless that not wanting to get involved involves something like failure to report if they're a mandated reporter or something like that. There's usually not, there's not a lot that can legally, practically be done. Now there's certainly pressure. And I do think that all of us, I think that there's so much conversation to be had around the cancel culture and, you know, why do we want to be a world that just cancels people as opposed to engaging in dialogue and trying to make changes? Like, do we want to just cancel people blanketly? But I think that we all make choices in our daily lives and just, you know, as we go about it, what kind of services we're going to use or what kind of service providers we're going to use. And we make those decisions based on all sorts of factors. It might have to do with price. It might have to do with, you know, I once met that guy who fixes refrigerators and he was obnoxious to me, so I don't want to have him come fit. Like we all make these decisions based on all sorts of various factors. And one of those factors, certainly, if this is a priority to you, if abuse prevention and if the well-being of survivors is a priority to you, then it should be one of the factors that you consider when making a decision of what kind of, you know, what stores am I going to shop in and what, like I said, what services or service providers am I going to employ and things like that. It certainly, I think, should be a part of a factor in those decisions when we make them.
Okay, so let's talk about some cases, examples. Maybe you can bring up some examples that you've worked with, and then I have a case I would like to bring up.
A really good example is the case that I mentioned that, well, I can't say which case it is actually yet because it hasn't, it's going to be shared soon, but of a very prominent teacher who was abusing girls in a school. And the school knew, and that's very obvious to us, to everyone involved, to the victims. The school knew for a long time. And not only did they not address it, but they actively continued promoting her. And even at the point where she was arrested and she was on house arrest awaiting trial for sexual abuse against her students. And it was during Corona, and they had her continue teaching by phone because they were doing all their classes by phone. And they were like, well, it's no risk, which it might be true. There might not be a physical risk to the students in that moment if she's teaching them by phone. One could argue she can't physically touch them if they're not there. But even if you want to say that there's no risk in terms of actual abuse, which that isn't accurate, but let's say there isn't, what kind of message are we sending as a community if we have somebody who's been accused of sexual assault and rape, which are tremendous crimes and tremendous averos, like they're not, this isn't like, this is against the Torah, that we have those people teaching Torah and Musar and Halacha, and that's insane. The truth is we're dealing with another case like that right now of Yehuda Weinberg, who's the principal of Shiviti Seminary, and is the same thing. He's still running the seminary. He's awaiting the proceeding. The prosecutor's office has the case and they're deciding how to proceed, and he is still running the school. And parents who sent their daughters and paid good money, because seminary is not cheap, to send their daughters to Israel to study, and they are being taught by a man who is currently accused of serious sexual abuse of a little girl. And that's insane to me. Like, how are parents not screaming and yelling and losing their minds? Like, I sent my daughter to Israel to learn with someone who's like, no, this is not acceptable. And even if he's no risk, the courts basically ruled that he can teach as long as there's at least 15 girls in the classroom. That was their safety rules. But that's the court. The court has to rule on very black and white. Where is the community? Where, like, all of the people who are allowing this to happen? It is a crazy thing. And it's really, like, it's absolutely time for all of us to stand up and be like, no, this is insane and it's not acceptable. And it's up to us to do that because we know that systems don't change themselves. They get changed when people make enough noise.
Yeah. And I'm listening and I'm hearing these cases for the first time. Where do I stay up to date so I can participate in sharing this information? Instagram?
Some on Instagram, some on Facebook, some is in the media. I mean, for us, like we have our own social media for, you know, for our cases. I think it's hard because for better or worse, we live in such a global world and community now that there's like cases in one country that very much affect things that are happening somewhere else, even though they don't really have anything to do with you directly. And I definitely hear that sometimes. Like I get contacted about cases in other countries and I'm like, I have very little to do. If there's anything I can do, I will try, but still it all affects each other and we all affect each other. And we need to be very conscious of the fact that we're affecting each other for the good and not for the bad. Social media is certainly good and the mainstream media is good. It's hard because it's gotten more and more difficult. Certainly, I know in the US, it's very difficult to find Jewish media outlets that will cover stories of sexual abuse. They really almost never will.
Why?
Call out to any journalists or media outlets that might be listening. Please start covering these stories.
Really important.
It's really important. It's one of the major tools that we have in our toolbox to deal with these kinds of situations is the public exposure. That is often the way to get the word out there. I mean, we're on Facebook. We have two different platforms on Facebook. One is for our like organizational stuff. And then we have a whole platform called Lotus Shtok, which is really just the platform for survivors' voices, amplifying survivors' voices from the Haredi community, like sharing their stories and their messages, which is really important. And then we're on Instagram too.
Okay, so I'll bring up this case. It's related to the music industry. And there are several questions that come to mind for me. So you mentioned cancel culture and how do we cancel? Who do we cancel? Do we cancel? How far would it go with enablers? So this case is public and it's Aaron Teitelbaum, who is active in the music industry. There have been videos that surfaced 2 years ago, a victim calling Aaron up and having him confess to doing things, but to someone else. There was another name mentioned on it. And then there were several journalists / influencers who covered the case, didn't mention his name, but it went nowhere. He's still around. There are people who still work with him, people who still hire him. When I was speaking to you before this episode, you said, It's not illegal to be a creep. I think those were your words.
Yeah, some intuition was.
And I invited you to this conversation because I want to know what can be done. What can we expect of people? And how does this enabling of enablers, how far does this go?
There's so many questions I might need you to ask me a few times so I can say I'm thinking of so many things. So first of all, as far as that particular case of Teitelbaum, so I was never personally involved in that case. So I can only speak to it sort of in general, but I am familiar. I'm familiar with the recording and I can definitely say that it is authentic and it's really disappointing. I will start by saying that it is really, really disappointing when people who the truth is even whether or not we respect people, but like just the fact that somebody is a public figure and doesn't draw a hard line with things like this, it is very disappointing. I will just put that out there. To me, it's always disappointing and sad because there's like an opportunity there. And yeah. So I think that from what I've heard that some of the reason that people have pushed back or have been unwilling to take active steps in dealing with him is because, you know, the allegations that were referred to in that recording are from many years ago. I'm going to get to in a second, the difference between what's like legal and communal. There were additional allegations that I am privy to and have also seen the information about of harassment and creepy behavior that was very recent involving adults, such as women in the industry. I would not want to be caught alone anywhere with him. I will say that based on the way he talks, but that's obviously not what we're referring to in the recording. And I don't want to conflate issues, but maybe that's what I was referring to when I said that it's not illegal to be creepy. It's not illegal to be creepy, but it's creepy to be creepy. And we can make decisions about how much we want to spend time or employ creepy people. And obviously the line between creepy and harassment can be very narrow. And that line, and not to what I wanted to say about the difference between the law and the community, because there's a lot of things that are not illegal, but they're highly inappropriate, especially if we're talking about, like, as from Jews. I've started to talk about this more in, like, the last year or two, how I, for many years, like most advocates that work in this field from the from community, always was, like, very into the, we don't, like, rabbis shouldn't be involved in abuse, meaning abuse should be reported to the authorities. It is the authorities' job to deal with abuse. We shouldn't be going to rabbis to get, kind of pushing back on also, like, the Aguda directive was of, like, you have to get permission however you want to put it, from a rabbi before you go to the police, and just totally pushing back on, like, that is not appropriate. Now, that is not meaning, and it's also illegal. Telling someone that they have to go to anyone before they go to the police is illegal. It's, yeah, you are, like, every person who is a victim of a crime, assuming they live in a Western country where they have the right to seek law enforcement intervention, has the right to go to the police. Telling them they're not allowed to do so, that's not allowed. But with all of that said, I think that for so long we were so focused on that we also weren't thinking about all of the various inappropriate behaviors that are not illegal, but are absolutely unacceptable, or should be unacceptable. On paper, they're unacceptable from Jews. Like, if you can't have it both ways, we can't tell Beis Yaakov girls that they will get thrown out of school for wearing skirts that are too short, and then refuse to address the fact that there are adult men who are constantly commenting or looking at or trying to look up the girl's short skirts. Like, you can't have, it's gotta be either we just don't care. Either we are a community that doesn't care. We don't care about CS. We don't care about boundaries. We don't care about modesty. We don't care about any of those things. Or we do care, and then we need to actually care about the people that are abusing those values, which is what perpetrators of harassment and sleazy behavior are doing. So it's like, I don't think that Rabbanim should be giving directives of you can and can't go to the police. They should not be doing that. It's not okay. It's illegal. It's not all right. But we absolutely need Rabbanim in various roles within this space and dealing with these issues, because there are so many cases where there isn't anything for law enforcement to do. But as a community, we should be able to stand up and say, no, this is not acceptable. We are a community of values. We are a community that's very into our safeguards and our, you know, we like our walls and our rules and we're all very into that. So, like, let's actually be consistent and enforce that when it comes to people who are being really inappropriate. So yeah, I think that when it comes to enablers, that's really more I'm not talking about active enablers, like I said at the beginning. There are often laws being broken in those cases, and there are active steps that can be taken and should be taken, because it's the only way it's going to stop. And it's the only way that they'll think twice next time when they are faced with this kind of situation again. But when it comes to the passive enablers, I think it's really more about communal pressure. And I don't even mean things like protests or... You said something, I don't remember the words that you used, about how this case has, nothing really came of it. I don't actually agree, because I think that every time that a story is told, we don't know, and I have seen this, like, you really don't know the ripple effects of where that's gone. And I think that the people that have been pushing to make sure that people are aware of this story, they have no idea. And I know how frustrating it is. I don't want to negate the frustration where you see that somebody who you know has been inappropriate, forget that, has been straight up abusive, but also, and also inappropriate, you know, more recently, is still being employed in such a public space and being employed. And that is really, really frustrating and disappointing to see. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there may be many others who have made decisions not to work with this person or not to work with that person. Or, you know what, I have a choice here between X and Y, and I'm going to go with Y, because I'm not comfortable with what I've heard about X's priorities and who they work with. Like, there's a lot that we never know the full extent of just sort of the effects of the work that we do and the voices that we put out there. I remember once I was having lunch it was a long story. I was with family friends, and we were at someone's house for Shabbos lunch, and the husband, like, mentioned to me, I didn't even realize that who he was, that he was a victim of abuse, of very severe abuse as a child. And his story had been told years ago anonymously at an event that I was hosting. I hadn't realized it was him, like, that it was, he told me this, and I, like, almost fell off my chair. But, and he said, like, you know, he never, because nobody knew it was him, So the story was told and he didn't know. And it was a very powerful and horrifying story. And he was like, I'm sure that like people heard it and read, but I don't actually know. Now, usually when something like that happens, I can't say, oh yes, it absolutely made an impact in X, Y, and Z ways. Like I don't, that particular story, I remember that after that event, a survivor reached out to me and she said that she had been abused as a teenager. And because of that story, she decided to track down her abuser. And she did. And she found him. And he was teaching at a different school. He had been thrown out of the school, last school. He had gone school to school, camp to camp. And he was at a different school. And because of this, she decided to call the school. And the school took it seriously. And they had her. She was interviewed by their lawyer. And they ended up, he was fired. He was forced to leave education. Unfortunately, it was passed the statute. So there was nothing that could be done criminally. She did file civil litigation, whatever that was, that did what it had to do. But yeah, she actually tracked down her abuser and stopped him from working with children because of this story. So I was able to tell this guy, like, actually, there was this case and this is what happened because of your story. And he was shocked and so happy. Like, but usually we don't know. Like, that's rare that we actually have a specific example to give. But there are so many repercussions and effects. And I think that no one should ever discount the power of their voice, whether they're a survivor or an ally of survivors. Like, it's important to keep using that voice, even if there isn't anything legally to do, or even if like on a communal level, there isn't something that can officially be done. There's always what to be done. And we have to always like use those. We have that power and we need to just keep using it and little by little making that change.
I'm in a position potentially, okay, for example, there are people who work with him or associate themselves with him. They don't like him, whatever. If I collaborate with those people who, as they said, they're not friends with them, they happen to be working at the same event or whatever it is, or they're working for someone, right, and I'm referring to a different case, should I be not collaborating with those people, whether it's coming onto my podcast or having any musical collaborations in the future? How far does this enablers right, go in the chain? And doing this episode is my way of trying to intervene and publicize and bring more awareness to the story.
I think that in general, that's such a it's such a hard question because, like I said, I think that it's much easier to make like hard and fast rules when it comes to the active enablers than it is with the passive enablers, because it's so, like you said, like where, how far does it go? It becomes extremely difficult to like figure out, okay, well, how much could they do? What are they not doing that they should be doing? Or what are they doing that they shouldn't be doing? When it gets, the further removed it gets from the actual abuse itself, the harder it becomes. So I've had situations, very awkward situations, where I have been at events, forget enablers, where I've been at events and actually realized that I was sitting at a table or was somewhere near an actual perpetrator. Now, depending on the nature of the case, if it's not public and if I'm not allowed to make it public, I am like sitting there dying because I don't know. Like, I, first of all, God forbid someone should take a picture of me in person. And then like somehow this becomes like, there's some sort of like cheskat kashrut that I'm giving this person because I'm sitting next to them. I'm like, I need to get out of this. I have left events because I was there and there was an abuser there that I knew was an abuser, but nobody else knew was an abuser. And I couldn't tell anyone that they were an abuser. And I was afraid to be, I mean, first of all, I'm deeply uncomfortable being in this person's presence, obviously. But even if I could put that aside for the sake of like, I can't tip this person off that I know, I can't say, I don't want anyone to see me with this person and think that they're safe or think that somehow this is a reflection, like, or afterwards when they find out to think, how could she have spoken to that person? You know, there's so many, anyways. Yeah. It's like,
and why can't you share the information? Is it because the client request
the client's
that?
Not ready yet. Yeah, the client's right, okay, not ready. A lot of times survivors contact us. They're not ready to do anything with it yet. They're not ready for anyone to know. They certainly don't want the perpetrator to know that they've shared it with anyone. So if I start making a scene or do it, like, then they're gonna know that somehow this is, you know, I've had that happen and I'm like playing dumb and it's very, very difficult of a position to be in. But I mean, I don't like, whatever, it's fine. I can get over that. It's not that big a deal. But on a community level, we always have. And I feel like this is for any rabbi or for any, you know, for me, I'm in the position that I'm in. So it's a specific kind of issue with me being seen as But for any person who's in a public space to be collaborating with someone who's not a safe person or is a morally just highly questionable person or anything like that is really, really, it's really difficult. It's really upsetting. It sends a message. So I think that when it comes to the active enablers, it's easier to have a very clear line of not working with someone who's actively enabling abuse. When it comes to the passive enablers, I think it ends up becoming so much like a case-by-case basis of how close, meaning what are we talking about by enabling? Were they just at the same event with someone? Like is every person who's at an event with a, are they obligated to not be at the event? Are they working directly with the person? Are they working indirectly with the person? Are they just in the same physical space as the person? I have been invited to speak on panels with people who I knew were really problematic. And I have had situations where I've turned down, like I've refused to go or to attend because I don't want to take a chance of somebody seeing me with this person and it saying anything about who, either them or anything. In some situations, if it was the same event, but not on the same panel. So I will agree if I can be like really stay far away and I don't feel like my presence is going to be any kind of reflection on them or vice versa. There's always a balance of like, is the good that I'm doing, like if I'm here sending a positive message, can I help negate any of the negativity of whatever this person is going to be saying? I mean, obviously I'm talking about speaking here, but yeah, that can be very, very tricky. And I think that in every situation, like, I mean, I have the people that I look to for advice of like, how do I handle this particular, like in each particular case. And I think that it's something that ends up needing to be, but I do think that it's always a good opportunity. Like if you do have the opportunity, it's always good to ask those questions. That's a conversation worth having. And I think that it can also be educational for the community to hear like, okay, this maybe wasn't the right, you know, maybe I made the wrong decision here. Maybe I made the right decision here. Maybe these are the factors, but I acknowledge that this is complicated and potentially hurtful. I think that those conversations could be positive. Like if we're talking about cancel culture and what the people who are against cancel culture promote of like, let's have dialogue and actually try to teach or learn or to, you know, kind of impart wisdom onto others as opposed to just cutting them off. So yeah, if you have an opportunity to do that, then that could be really, really positive.
So you said something about the passive enablers and sometimes it's rabbis saying, you know, who am I? What can I do? Sometimes it's rabbis, but let's say it's a principal or it's a musician or anyone, you know, an employer.
So employers, there's always things that do need to be taken into account. Like if I found out that my employer was abusive, so I would want to leave. I would very much want to leave. Like no one would have to tell me that I should want to leave. I would just want to leave.
I meant the reverse, but keep talking.
Okay. But I would want to leave. And what would probably end up happening like on a practical level, because I also have to pay my rent and like buy my children food, is that I would have to first find another job, which might take a little while. So I think there does have to be some understanding like of when it comes to people working with perpetrators or even working with enablers of like there is a time frame in which I would not say like, you know, you terrible, evil person, you are working with someone. Like people also need to live. And if they didn't know that, then they're also now probably in shock. Probably this isn't something that they saw coming and now will need to make their own, you know, get away, extract themselves from the situation. So of course there's that. Employers can be tricky. But yeah, I don't think like to me, it's just also like a given that nobody would want to work with someone that they know is not safe or that they know is like has done evil things. Like, why would you want to work with someone?
Somehow, when it's something in the past, like 20 years ago, somehow people are more forgiving.
I think that people also have, and this is a more general statement about abuse in general, people often don't understand how serious abuses. Like there, I think that we put, first of all, I mean, this is, we're getting into so many different
harassment sort of cheapened abuse because everyone thinks they're abused when they're harassed. And then you forget that actual abuse happens.
No. I don't even think it's that. I think no, actually not at all. I think that people mentally sort of put abuse into the same category as either like thinking bad thoughts. I hear this a lot also about child sexual abuse material, child pornography, where people are like so willing to like say like, oh, it was just, he didn't actually touch anyone. I once, for a case that I was working on, I once had to read a like a detailed summary of the child pornography that had been found on a perpetrator, from perpetrator, a guy who was making aliyah, on his computer, like it was an FBI, like from the federal court. And I don't think I've ever, and I've read and seen and heard some really horrifying things in my life, and I don't think I've ever been as sick, as physically ill, as I was after reading that document. People do not understand how depraved sexual abuse can be, even the minor sexual abuse, the molestation, the acts of what are going on, and the fact that we're not just talking about somebody who like saw something for a minute. We're talking about people who are looking at materials or doing these things to achieve sexual gratification. That says something about a person. A person who's capable of seeing that kind of image or experiencing that kind of experience, and is instead of their reaction being, oh my God, I think I'm going to throw up, is actually a sexual response, that something's deeply wrong. Like there's something deeply, deeply wrong there, and people don't allow themselves. Now, I understand why people don't allow themselves to think about that in detail, because it's horrifying. And because we would never sleep at night. I would never sleep at night. Like we try to think about it in sort of clinical terms because we hear sexual abuse or sexual abuse. No, it's not just a word. It's horrifying acts that have destroyed someone's like mental well-being in such deep ways. So it was 20 years ago. Like that's not meaning that, but it's horrific. Like 20 years is not, it's not like I was 17 and I stole from a drugstore. Like, okay, you can go back to the drugstore and you can pay them back. And we all do stupid things when we're teenagers. That's not what sexual abuse is. That's not. And I think that people have their own, like, first of all, there's a cognitive dissonance where we don't want to believe or want to consider certain things. And then I think also, especially, and I see this so much in the FROM community, and I see it a lot from men, because there is so much conversation and focus around, you know, the negative sexual thoughts and the evil sexual thoughts, which is really all sexual thoughts. And because we put all that into that category, and then sexual abuse gets kind of shoved in there as well. So it's like all the same thing. So they're just thinking, okay, well, I also had Yetzirahs and Taivas when I was, you know, when I was a teenager. And I also maybe looked at things that I shouldn't have looked at. And I, you know, like I stood outside the pool at my, you know, the community pool, and I looked at all the people in their bathing suits, and I had impure thoughts. And that was, you know, so it's like, okay, we've all done bad things. No. That's not the same thing. And I think that until people at least have to like take a few moments to understand the gravity of what we're talking about, it doesn't matter if it was 20 years ago. It doesn't matter if it was 30 years ago. Someone who was capable of doing something that, and I do want to just, it is important because I don't want to, there is such a thing as a naive offender when it comes to children and teenagers, like adolescent or child offenders, where they truly did not understand the seriousness and the gravity of what they were doing. We do deal with that sometimes. 13-year-olds who molested their 6-year-old siblings, they really didn't understand what they were doing. That happens. It is important. It is critical that it be dealt with therapy. Those children can often go through real full rehabilitation program. Like they can really be fine and grow up to lead very healthy lives. I'm not talking about that. He was not a child. He was an adult. And that's not something that like, okay, well, you don't engage in such severe behaviors and then just be like, yeah, I grew out of it. Like, that's not the same thing. I think that it's important that people understand that distinction. And obviously every case is different and every survivor's experience is unique and everything, you know, it's always hard when you speak like in general terms. I don't ever want to like paint any one or anyone's experience at all, but like overall, I would say that I think that that is something that's really important that people understand and grasp. And it does make a difference in terms of then how you react moving forward.
Just being involved with this behind the scenes and in different cases, just you get so much information. And then, yeah. No, if people go to their Rabbanim and then you're like, who are those Rabbanim that are saying it's okay to keep working with somebody when they're publicly a horrible person and privately? So,
I mean, who are the Rabbanim? It's a good question, but I think it's also like, who, I mean, yes, there is.
Because people say, I went to my Rav. That's the answer you get. And maybe they didn't. Maybe they did. But there is this accepted culture that you get a psak, and the rabbi could say, don't tell anyone that you can't just go around publicizing that this is your psak or that it came from me. That's becomes, an accepted.
Which really becomes like baloney, because it's like you could just, I mean, like I Googled it. Like you could just say that about anything. I don't know, like, what does that even mean? I think that when it comes to like, I asked my Rav, number one, I always tell survivors, I mean, I work with a lot of survivors from the very Haredi community, like Israeli, extremely, like there's no, a lot of, it's a given that many of the people that we work with are going to want to go to the Rav. So one of the things that we always talk about is that you need to understand that sexual abuse needs to be treated as murder. Like, as pikuach nefesh. So just like you wouldn't, if you went to the Rav of your shul, and you asked him about an abortion, a medically, you know, required abortion because of danger to the mother, your community Rav of your shul is not going to answer that question. He shouldn't most likely be answering that question unless he has some sort of other vast experience. If you're asking a halachic question of that gravity, they're going to send you to some kind of gadol, and not just any gadol, because the gadol hador might not know anything about the medical. Like, there are specific rabbanim who have spent huge amounts of time with doctors and with medical professionals and are familiar with the actual halakhic ramifications. Directors.
Who are the rabbis who are experts in sexual abuse?
Don't ask that. I can't.
Well, Rav Yaakov Horowitz, would you say that's an expert rabbi? He wrote the book?
Well, he is definitely very, very familiar with this idea. And I don't think he would consider himself a gadol. He's more
no one considers themselves a gadol. I've tried saying to somebody, oh, are you a leader? Can you speak on this? Oh, who am I?
No, he definitely is has a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience when it comes to abuse. I think that he has been, I've known many survivors that have reached out to him. And yeah, but I'm saying in terms of like, I'm also in Israel, so it's a little bit different. I don't think any survivor that I'm dealing with would contact Horowitz for a psak to go to the police. I don't think they would call him.
No, I'm talking about enablers.
Oh, so
the passive enablers.
When it comes to working with enablers and things like that. So let's put the first thing aside. When it comes to questions about abuse, if there is a halakhic question to be asked, which there shouldn't be so many, but if there are halakhic questions to be asked in the subject of abuse, they need to be asked of someone who really has a lot of experience with this, or somebody who is willing to work with professionals, like is willing to say, I don't know enough about this. We're going to need to speak to a professional. And on that basis, I will give you the halachic answer. That's number one. That's when it comes to actual abuse. In general, when it comes to like the whole, I asked my Rav, the problem is that like, who's your Rav? It sounds like that statement can be just a total cop out. I don't know who their Rav is. I don't know. But also like, if you punch me in the face and then tell me that it's okay because you asked your Rav, like, does that make it all right? Like, Hashem created all of us with brains. We're supposed to use them. If something doesn't make any sense, first of all, why did you even go to the Rav? There's a question of like, if something is common sense, if you went to a Rav, then you were already
questioning something,
not sure about something. There was something that wasn't clear. And that's already like, in my mind, it's like, what was unclear to you about the situation that you had to go to the Rav? And then the question becomes, what did you ask the Rav? Because the number of times that I have spoken to survivors who are like, I asked my Rav, he said no. And I was like, but did you tell the Rav this? Did you tell the Rav this? And you tell the Rav this? The Rav is only going to answer.
You sound like a yoetzet.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that is sort of what I am when it comes to abuse, because people like to pretend that Rabbanim are like, that they are the Sanhedrin, that they are Nevi'im, and that they're all knowing, and that they somehow have some direct communication with God, and that they know all the things, even if you didn't tell them. They don't. Nobody today does. And if they claim they do, they should be hospitalized, most likely, or put in jail. Nobody has that kind of all-encompassing knowledge. A Rav will answer a halachic question based on the information that you provide to him. If you don't give him all the information, he's not going to answer an accurate, like, it's... So, yeah, I remember once we had a case that we dealt with where the Rav, this woman had witnessed abuse. It was a weird situation. She was on a bus. She saw into someone's yard. She saw a man molesting, it was most likely his daughter, horrible situation. She was absolutely distraught, obviously. She wanted to go to the police. Her husband called his Rav. The Rav said, no, shouldn't get involved, shouldn't go to the police. The woman was absolutely devastated. She was calling us at all hours of the day and night. She wanted to go to the police. We wanted her to go to the police. And so I said, could we try speaking to the Rav? And the husband was like, I don't know. Go ahead. I mean, you want to speak? You can speak to the Rav. I don't care. He told me no. So we called the Rav. Our staff member, all he said to him was, listen, she hasn't been sleeping. It's affecting their shalom bias. That's it. The sentence went, it went that far. And he said, well, then of course she should go to the police. Like, he didn't even get into the whole, like, okay, so, I mean, I would have preferred he said she should just go to the police from the get-go. But, like, the husband had never told the Rav, my wife wants to go to the police. She feels like it is the right thing to do, and she really can't deal with the reality that she's letting this go. He never said that. He just said, my wife saw this thing happen. Should she go to the police? That was the question. That's not the whole question. That isn't all the information. So it should be yes. It absolutely should be yes. But there is, for sure, I agree, to be very clear. It should have been yes anyway. We've had women contact us who are married to men who are abusing their kids. And we just recently had a woman. And she said, I went to the Rav and I asked him if I should get divorced. And he, like, I wanted him to tell me that I should get divorced. And he wouldn't tell me that I should get divorced. And we were like, there is no Rav in the world who's going to tell you, you should get divorced. No one's going to say those words. You need to, did you tell him you want to get divorced? No, she didn't want to tell him. She wanted him to just with his like magical Ruach HaKodesh, she wanted him to tell her that she, Hashem wants her to get divorced. That's what she wanted to hear. He's not going to say that to her. That's not how the questions, like people also just need to become like educated consumers when it comes to asking Shilas. Like you need to actually ask the whole question. And you also need to know when there is a question, because if something is common sense, then why do you even need to go to the Rav if you just know with your own brain that Hashem gave you that this is not good? Then just make the decision on your own. Like if you're going to a Rav, it already implies that there's something that's not clear here. So then the question becomes like, was the question asked as, do I have to leave this job? Was it asked as, should I leave this job? Was it asked as, what sort of message does it send if I don't leave this job? Like, I don't even know. I don't know what that question was. And those answers are all going to be different.
Thanks to this episode now, this information is public. Now, everyone who has listened to this episode, without you choosing to opt into this, you are now participating in spreading the information and making sure you make an educated choice when you hire your next performer, musician, whatever it is. I'm just saying these two jobs because that relates to the specific case. But we need to be more proactive as a community, because every individual person is going to make a difference, because there's no leadership, quote unquote, that's going to take care of it for us. It has to be grassroots.
100%. 100%. And we make that decision every single day. We vote with our feet. We vote with our money. We vote with our hands. We vote with the decisions we make. And I think that also it's important to keep it to realize that in the firm community, it's become so, we're a little elitist sometimes. We can be very classist. Sometimes we can be. And there's a lot of, if you're lucky enough to get your kid accepted into that school, then how dare you start asking questions about their safety policies? We need to stop thinking like that. Our children are diamonds and treasures that were given to us by God. They are gifts, and we are supposed to protect them. The second we start seeing the institutions, whatever those institutions are, as being like more important than our children, no, you have the right to ask. Not only of the right, you have the obligation to ask all those questions and to push back. I'm not saying you need to be the loudest, biggest troublemaker every single time. That's obvious. Like, you know, it's a lot of responsibility to put on each individual parent there. But every parent has a voice. Every person has a voice. And we should all use our voices and little by little make those differences.
What is a win in your space, and how do you celebrate your wins?
That is a great question. That might be the best question anyone has ever asked me.
Oh, go ahead.
Because it's really so individual. And I would say that it's an active job or task to remind ourselves how individual it is. Because it's very easy sometimes, you know, like there are certain things that we just by definition sort of work on for so long. A conviction, you know, in court of somebody who has wrecked such havoc on so many lives for so many years. And until we finally get it to the point, you know, the survivor is ready. And until we get to, but first of all, that's not really our win. It's not really us. That's the survivor and the law and the system of law enforcement. The fact that we pushed and made sure that all the pieces aligned, we share in that, but that's not our success. to us, really, the success is always when a survivor feels like they've succeeded. So that can be, it can be something in court. It can be a conviction. It can be an arrest. Those moments can definitely be very emotional. Just that feeling of like after so much work that the streets are a little bit safer. Also, survivors who have make like significant sort of headway in therapy, we get some very emotional, like really, really touching feedback and thank you sometimes of survivors that we like help get into therapy or help connect to different resources. And then after months or years, they have some sort of significant breakthrough in their lives as a result of that treatment. So we recently had a woman who suffered from infertility as a result of trauma. Like it was really a psychosomatic, and her doctors for years had told her that there was no physical cause to the infertility. She was in therapy, really intensive trauma therapy that we helped her get into for almost 2 years. And she just recently sent us a message that she's expecting. That was like a huge, just really emotional and meaningful. And then, yeah, there's some that like, I've been to high school graduations of survivors who I didn't know if they were going to make it another day at certain points in their adolescence. Like really, I remember being at a high school graduation with a mother and she looked at me and she said, "Remember when I used to call you every day because I didn't know if he was going to wake up the next morning?" And he is doing so well. And it's just so like, it's so unbelievable. So yeah, every time there's a wedding or a graduation, whether it be college, high school, like just a milestone that somebody feels like they've managed to achieve because of the work that we've helped them to do, those are the successes. And it's really
celebrate.
Unbelievable. How do we celebrate? Not enough. I'll be very honest. We do not celebrate enough. There's very much, and we always joke about this, but to be fair, I don't think this makes it any better. If anything, it's worse. We also don't grieve enough of the bad. Like I'm saying this out loud because it's also important. Like I always have to remind myself, I do a lot of this, like, yes, yes, very sad, like moving on because we hear such horrible things and then we have to move on to the next thing right away. So there isn't enough time given to really fully process like both the grief and also the celebration when it happens. But yeah, mostly it's with others. I think it's very like, we have a very active WhatsApp group for our staff, which is like less of the official work stuff that we have a system for, like, just our happy moments of, you know, new babies of, you know, that when survivors send us pictures and all different things like that. And we really like talk a lot in there and there's a lot of celebrating and we always share it. Even like I've been working in this field for a while now and some of our staff are newer. So a lot of the times it's like, I'll share stories that are about survivors that they don't even know because it was like from a while ago, but it's so like, you can just see in their reactions also that there's so much of a feeling of shared effort and shared working towards this goal of just wanting survivors to feel like to realize that they're not alone and to feel like they're supported and to be able to get through all these milestones in life. So that's very meaningful and we can do that.
Well, thank you for coming on, Shauna. It was great speaking to you as always.
I'm glad we finally made it happen. I feel like we talked about this a few times over the years.
Do you know about the book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution?
No.
It's written by Louise Perry. I just finished the audio book version. It shook me. The idea is liberal feminism and the whole empowering the woman and her sexuality. And she dismantles all that and says how it's all horrible. If you're watching pornography, you're watching people being raped and prostitution is not empowering and sex work is not work, like all that. My comment is adjacent to this is like Law and Order, media that's helping victims in a world of liberal feminism and just Western liberalism. The cases you get are usually not like I was drunk and making stupid decisions and it got violated. It's more the hardcore, old-fashioned, traditional people in clear power, minors. Yeah. Because you're in the firm community, do you have less of this liberal feminism, like Law and Order, SVU type cases?
So first of all, I mean, I was a pretty religious Law and Order watcher until started having issues with my Hulu account. So I haven't watched it in the last couple seasons. But I think most of their cases are pretty black and white, but they definitely do. I mean, part of the idea of the show is like challenge all the different conceptions and misconceptions and beliefs that people have about abuse and about rape. I think that, yes, first of all, because we're in the firm community, on the one hand, that is the case, but not necessarily. I think it's a myth that that is such a huge number. Like the vast majority of cases of abuse that get reported in general are abuse. Like abuse took place there. And there's a, this is like a whole conversation in itself. I remember once, shortly after I had my daughter, there was like a lot of conversations that were going on online then about how like, stop teaching your daughters how to avoid being raped and teach your sons about how not to rape. Okay, well, and I really, really resented that because I just felt like, well, what if I want to do both? Because what if I want, and what do I mean by that? I don't mean, first of all, obviously I, being who I am going to teach my sons not to rape. Like that's, it, I mean, that's like a kind of a crass way to put it. I'm going to teach them about what consent is and what boundaries are in all areas, not just when it comes to sex. Like this is a misconception also that people have that in the from, you can't talk about, like, what is there to talk about consent until marriage? Is there, there's no sex. No, no, it's not consent. It's not just about sex. It's not like there's so much more than that. And there's so much. And I can assure you that my boys who are yeshiva boys and they are like, they are, so many conversations around concepts of like the topics of consent and boundaries and behaviors and lines and respecting people's lines and understanding body language ever. And without ever really getting into sex specifically, like just it's, yeah, it's so important. Also, I am going to teach my daughter all kinds of things. Now I'm not going to teach her that she needs to wear a long skirt because wearing short skirts is why people get raped. No, I'm not going to do that because I don't believe that's true. I don't believe it. It's not true. It is factually like there's research done about what women that were raped or assaulted were wearing. There is absolutely no correlation between women who are wearing more provocative clothing being raped to women who are wearing full garb in, you know, head to toe. But I think that there's such a thing as smart, you know, if you are a woman and you are out with friends, not leaving drinks unattended or not leaving, like there are things that you can do to be smart. That's not to say that if you didn't do those things, then you deserve to be assaulted, God forbid. Like the responsibility for assault always lies with the assaulter, always. But because I want to protect my daughter and I'm not willing to rely on the fact that all the mothers of the world have suddenly united and decided to tell their sons not to rape. I'm not going to rely on that. And I'm not going to sacrifice my daughter on the altar of liberal feminism by saying, no, no, you don't have to do anything. Don't do anything. Everyone is the world's obligation to protect you. They're not going to protect her. So I will tell her anything that I can tell her just to help her protect herself, but not because it's her responsibility when something happens, because there are smart practices of just the things that you do, unfortunately, because the world is what it is. So maybe I'm a bad feminist. I don't know. I'm just a very pragmatic person. So
well, that book, it shoots down the whole liberal feminism thing. It's basically saying the people who rape, telling them not to rape is not going to stop them. So,
well, I don't think it's about telling people that are raped not to rape. I think it's about telling the people. I had a case. It was before I even worked here. I used to work with at-risk teens and like in a program for girls at risk. And there was a case that was one of the most traumatic and also altering, life-altering, mind-altering cases that I dealt with, which was there were two young women that were in this program, and they went out together. One of them was going to see her boyfriend. She brought her friend because the boyfriend was bringing his friend. He wanted someone to hang out with while they were. The friend that went with her was not interested in hooking up with this guy. That's not what she was looking for. This was not, like, she wasn't interested. And basically, I was the staff person on call. The next morning, she came in and she had marks all over her body. She had been assaulted by this friend. And the friend, the female friend in the program, so she initially was really pressuring her, like, not to tell us because she didn't want, you know, her boyfriend was pressuring her that his friend was going to get in trouble if she told. And I just remember that part. The what he did was bad enough, but he is a criminal. And I've somewhat followed this guy over the years. I believe he's a criminal. I don't think like he's a person who I don't know what can be done for him. I'm not even going there. But the friend, it was the friend. And this is very apropos, maybe a good ending for
enabling
around enablers. The friend was like your very kind of typical 19-year-old semi like at risk, half OTD, semi yeshiva guy. And I remember him speaking to, we finally, like, he had a conversation with the one of the directors of our program because I was like, you got to get this guy to shut his mouth. Like, he needs to stop pressuring his girlfriend to pressure her. Enough. We're reporting this and he needs to shut his mouth. And he spoke to him. And I remember this guy said to the director of the program a statement that I will never forget for as long as I live. And it has really, like, it completely changed me. He finally said, after, like, a prolonged conversation, okay, fine. So he got a little bit rough, but who doesn't like it a little bit rough? And that to me, and this is a guy who, like, you know, he grew up from and now he was hanging out with girls and he was like, the criminal was the criminal. This guy is like the normative guy. This was guy was like, he was by all accounts a nice guy. He was the guy that, like, if he came home dating your daughter, like, you wouldn't fall off your tree. Like, he was a decent guy. And this is what he thought. Like, he actually believed that this was like, okay, it's not the night. Like, he didn't treat her so nicely, but like, it's not like the end of the world. Like, we're making a big deal out of nothing. And that was when I was completely like, we're broken. We are broken. If these are the messages that our boys that were raised in the Frum community with values of modesty or whatever that we're supposedly being raised with, if this is what he thinks, then our system is broken. And that, like, it shaped a lot of, like, that's not true. There was no, like, there is such a thing as consent and there is such a thing as enthusiastic consent, and people do need to understand. Now, I do think it has been a mistake that it's not a mistake. I don't want to say this wrong. I think that there's the way that victims were treated for so many years, decades and decades and decades of such mistreatment and such intense, like, you know, of you don't have a voice and your voice, there's been a necessary pushback of like how we present all of these issues. However, the challenge with that is that we've often fallen into this idea that like, every topic around sexual abuse, anything relating to sexual abuse is black and white. And that's not the case. There is such a thing as gray areas, especially when it comes to adolescence, where people don't understand dynamics, where people don't understand where and I have dealt with a couple cases like this, where a guy really genuinely believed that if he it wasn't okay what he did, but he really didn't understand that what he had done had caused such trauma. He was pushy and she eventually agreed after like a couple times. She said, yeah. And he was like, but you initially said you were going to be Shomer and then you weren't, whatever. And he was pushy and she said, okay, fine. And he said, but she consented in the end. And we said, but she said no twice until she finally consented. Now, is that a case that the prosecutor's office is going to agree to prosecute? No, they will not. They will not prosecute that in the end. Contrary to what SVU might tell you, the prosecutor's offices will never take those cases because they're just too hard to prove. It's not worth it for them. Did this guy deserve to sit in jail? I personally would have liked if he sat in jail for at least a couple days, because what he did, he caused unbelievable trauma, and he pushed and that's not okay. But I don't believe that he is evil or that he realized what he was doing to her. Like, I do think that there can be that room for what I called before, the naive perpetrator, especially when it comes to kids and teens, where they really don't understand the gravity of their actions. And that's on us. I think I felt like the perpetrator in that case is the educational system, is the adults who are giving toxic messages to youth. But that's not the same thing. That isn't the same. And I think that we get lost sometimes in the, like, once in a while there will be a case like that. For the most part, you know, if a woman is, or a man, and can also be assaulted. I remember once supporting a survivor who was a guy who said, I know it's nerdy and I know it's whatever, but I did not want to have sex until I was married. And I went with my friends to a lot. He was in yeshiva over a weekend and he got really, really drunk and he woke up with a girl in his bed and he did not remember what happened. And he realized that she must have had sex with him and he was horrified and felt violated. And then of course also couldn't tell anyone because he felt like, because everyone was just going to laugh at him because like,
what, you don't complain about,
waiting about you, you know, but no, he had a value and that was a violation and it was not okay. And he deserved to have support. And it was really devastating that he couldn't. There was like no one he could tell because no one would take him seriously. Yeah, that can happen. And it does happen. And it needs to be like, there needs to be, that's not okay. People need to know that that is assault. Like, people need to be fully consenting. I do think that pornography has been, I don't think that saying people rape because of porn, that's, again, it's like a cop out. Like, you don't just blame other, but I think that I think too many parents now allow their children to be like, to get their sex education through porn. Like, they don't understand that I think we all need to realize that our children are probably going to be exposed to pornography at some point, whether by themselves or by somebody showing it to them. And if we don't give a context to that, and if we don't explain to our children whether we want them to be seeing it or not, that what they're seeing is highly problematic, not just because it's not Stinus, not just because of Shamir Sinayim and Shamir Sabris, but because what's going on there is fake, it is staged, it's not real. it represents a dynamic which is generally very power distorted, generally against the woman. Women are generally being, I mean, that is all true. That is all true. And there's a lot of research to back that up. A very large percentage of women in adult film industry are being exploited, whether it's all of them or many of them, I don't know, but it's clearly a field with a lot of like, that's highly, highly problematic. But I don't think it's just like they're too sexualized, so they rape. But I think that there are incredibly unrealistic. I mean, just for example, I remember watching a TED talk by an educator who's done a lot of research about the effects of pornography on adolescents. And he was talking about the concept of no hand sex. The fact that in pornography, because they need to be able to see the genitals, that is generally the focus, there needs to be like a close up. So feet and arms tend to get in the way. So porn stars learn to do everything that they're doing with their hands behind their backs. You don't always see that. I mean, you don't see it. They're not meant to be in the frame. And that, he said, just that little detail alone is so misleading and is so inaccurate, because that's not how real humans, certainly loving humans, have sex with their hands behind their backs. It's not how sex works. And that there, and it creates such a distorted picture for boys and for girls of what is acceptable and what should be okay and what's supposed to work and what's not supposed to work. So I think it's incredibly dangerous to allow children to be, but not because of what, I don't think, like, people fall into the, like, well, they're hypersexualized, so people are going to rape. No, it's because they're being given toxic messages around sexuality, and they're not being given any context by parents or educators about boundaries and consent and all those things. Like, yes, that is creating a culture, and that creates a rape culture.
Well, I think you're going to love the book or hate it, but yeah.
Both. I mean, it sounds important. It certainly sounds, I do think that's an important conversation to have. I just often find that people often do fall into the extremes on both ends with those kinds of things. Like the statements of the Me Too movement has taken it too far. That's baloney, not because I certainly believe that it's possible that as a result of the Me Too movement, there have been some women out there that have done crazy things. It's entirely possible. There are a lot of unstable people in the world. They do all kinds of things that could have happened. But if you put it on balance in terms of the number of cases and the number, like, the, you know, false allegations are such a tiny percentage of the actual reports that are made, such a tiny percentage that having, like, focusing on that is like focusing. I have a friend whose brother was killed in a car accident because his seatbelt was buckled. In that particular instance, because of the way that the car crashed, had he been unbuckled, he might have survived. He died because he was trapped by his seatbelt. That is incredibly rare. And starting a campaign that people shouldn't wear seatbelts because of this person who, I'm sure it does happen. It can happen. But we're talking about like such a small percentage of the cases. We always need to deal with, you know, the majority. That is obviously what we have to be looking at here. And if the vast majority of cases of abuse are real, and in the vast majority of cases of abuse are never reported because the victims won't be supported or feel that they won't be believed, then that's where we really need to be putting most of our energy, not on the 2% of the cases. That's not to say they shouldn't be dealt with when they do come up. Of course, they have to be dealt with. But as far as like communal attention, we're missing the point.
Thank you so much, Shana. Sure. So good talking to you. We'll be in touch.
You too. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for sticking around until the end. Make sure to go and listen to our first episode with Shana Aronson if you'd like. Please rate and review this podcast. Share this podcast with a friend. Consider buying me a cup of coffee or sending me a nice message. This is a big deal. We're hitting 300 episodes next week. I hope you have a beautiful Pesach. Chag Kasher V'Sameach. May we find the freedom. Bring our hostages and soldiers back home, be safe, and check out those new music releases. Links in the show notes and Kol Isha. Thanks for your love. Dyantip.